call to order the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee and open a work session on Senate Bill 369. And what I would like to see us do, colleagues, is take the contents of House Bill 2415 and put it into Senate Bill 369, and would entertain a motion to do that.
So moved.
Colleagues, we have a motion before us to take the House Bill 2415 and move it into Senate Bill 369. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beyer.
That was the A and Gross version of 2415?
Yes, A and Gross version of House Bill 2415.
And we're doing that conceptually?
That's all in writing. We'll just move it into the bill. And yes, I guess that is conceptual. Even though he's on. Yes, yes, to proceed, we need to suspend the rules for conceptual amendment to change the date. We need 5 people here.
Which card is?
This is Mannix and his subcommittee.
Yeah, Mannix and his subcommittee. Okay, we'll be at ease. We will suspend the work session on Senate Bill 369 while we're searching out more members and go into a work session on House Bill 3635. And I'll call Representative Sherry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Sinceri, Representative District 22. We presented this bill at the request of former mayor of City of Gresham, Augusta McRoberts, and we've done the research and put this together and found some interesting information which I'd like to share with you. We also have some written information. We won't take a lot of time to go through that in our testimony so that you'll have opportunity to read it. But I would like to turn this over now to Tony Sinceri, my representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tony Sinceri for the resident. I'm a resident of Gresham, and I work for Representative Sinceri's legislative assistant. This bill was brought to you as a result of a problem that a constituent did have with a personal in-home care business. She received substandard care, and when she attempted to lodge a complaint, she found that these businesses are not regulated nor are licensed by the state. So when a public, a member of the public would call the Department of Human Resources or the Health Division to complain, they were unable to investigate that complaint because they are not regulated in any way. The purpose of this bill is to bring in-home care businesses under the supervision of the Oregon Health Division. I believe that requiring licensing and providing oversight to these unregulated businesses will ultimately protect the public from harm because of incompetent or substandard care. This bill also requires that employees of these businesses undergo an appropriate background check to screen out undesirable care providers. Currently, Oregon licenses and regulates home health agencies, and the purpose of this licensing is to monitor and to investigate complaints from the public. The parameters of care are clearly defined so that the public can have a certain degree of confidence that the level of care that they contract for is provided by a competent home health agency. The public deserves the same level of confidence in an agency they hire to provide in-home care.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I also would like to confirm with the Administrator that there is no impact to general fund for this bill, and we have worked as closely as we could in the time frame with Mr. Gallagher, who works with some of these organizations. So.
Mr. Mannix, do you have other obligations?
We are in the midst of voting some bills on public safety, so turning away from me.
Okay. Well, let's we need to go back and finish up the little work session on 369 just to maybe another minute or two. We will
we'll stand by if you have questions, Mr. Chair.
Very much. We'll suspend the work session on House Bill 3635 and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 369. We were in the midst of moving the content of House Bill 2415 into Senate Bill 369. And we need to do that. We need to have suspension of rules, I think, to do that, actually. So,
Chair, I move we suspend the rules for purpose of conceptual amendment.
To Senate Bill 369.
Right.
Okay, calls a motion for that we suspend the rules for purposes of considering conceptual amendments to Senate Bill 369. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beyer.
I move the contents of House Bill 2415A in gross into Senate Bill 369.
The cause of motion before us to move the contents of House Bill 2415A in gross version into Senate Bill 369. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And we have one question before us, colleagues, in, on page 23 of the A engrossed House Bill 2415, line 2 is a date indicating the start date for the effective measures, the political tax credit that's indicated in the bill. There has been some discussion about whether that should be 2000 or 2001. And would be happy to discuss that with Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, to be straightforward, I know this is an issue that relates to the governor's position on the bill. I would be more than happy to move it to 2000 at this point, discuss it with the governor's staff, and should they still not be satisfied with the bill, ask Senator Starr on the Senate side not to concur with it, and then we can change it to 2001 in conference committee. And still get the other important elements of the bill through this body. I don't agree with the governor's reasoning for vetoing the bill in the first place, and the governor didn't communicate with, I believe, any member of the rules committee prior to his veto, so I'd like to communicate with him at this time.
Open a dialogue about what may be acceptable or not acceptable.
Yeah.
We do have some word that 2001 would be acceptable, but it would be beneficial perhaps to vote it in sooner if we could do so. Further discussion?
One other item, Mr. Chairman. Part of the reason for this bill was to try to get rid of voter confusion over the changes that have occurred because of the Supreme Court's decision delaying the implementation date of this bill. And further that confusion, and I think some people could explain that to the governor's staff, and that's why I would prefer the 2000 date.
Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to conceptually amend the bill on page 23 of the original HB 2418A, line 2, would be January 1st, 2000.
The motion before us, colleagues. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, so ordered. I would entertain a motion. Representative Beyer, do you move to move, to, move the bill before the House to do pass as amended and before the House to do pass recommendation?
So moved.
Any objection, colleagues?
Just a question?
Yes.
As I understand it, we now have 2415 in 369 with a change of the date from January 1, 99 to January 1, 2000.
Correct.
Fine. Thank you. That's a nice package.
Thank you. So you did a lot of work on that bill.
There's a writing clause, but I won't suggest any other conceptual.
How to get that.
Did not go unnoticed, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sure it didn't. There's very little that escapes your watchful eyes at the minute. I appreciate your work. Further discussion on the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Devlin, do you want to carry the bill?
I'll carry the bill.
Carry the last time. You can carry the bill again. Okay, that closes the work session on Senate Bill 369. We will reopen the work session on House Bill 3635. Let's just be fair. If you care to come back up here.
Well, let's get back in the room. Let's just go.
Thank you. Yes, if you'd let staff indicate the report.
Mr. Chair, committee members, a formal report has not been submitted to request from the fiscal office yet.
However, when staff reviewed the bill, please note on page 1, line 25 and 231, talks about fees. On line 25 to 26, the fee for initial licensure shall not exceed $500. And on line 29-30, the fee shall not exceed the cost of administering the provisions under sections 1 and 6 of this act. You also note on page 2 and 4, line 10, that the administrative rules necessary for implementation should take place by the Department of Human Resources. And then on line 17, 20 talks about that the deposit should go into the state treasurer and credit the account related to administering these funds. So that, in other words, the authors of the bill have tried to make it fiscally neutral, so there will be no impact. So yes, we have not had opportunity because of the timing to get this summary question, Cisco.
No response to that. You did indicate in your previous testimony, I think, that there would be no fiscal.
Again, for the record, Ron Conseri, State Representative District 22, it was our intention that there would be no impact on the general fund and that this program would be self-sustaining. We also have, with this, Kathy, with the agency, that if you have some questions as far as the agency is concerned, she's prepared to answer.
Okay, thank you very much. The in-home care providers are physical therapists and such that travel around and help people rehabilitate from injuries, or is it hospice? Is it
Representative Simmons, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathleen Snail from the Oregon State Health Division. Part of the Department of Human Resources, and I'm the manager of the section that licenses and certifies home health agencies, among other entities. And our understanding of in-home care agencies as opposed to home health agencies is that home health agencies are agencies that are required by statute to provide skilled nursing and one other therapeutic service, such as physical therapy, speech therapy, and so forth. They are rehabilitative in nature, finite amount of time, provided in a coordinated fashion with physician's orders, whereas an in-home care agency is more maintenance. It can be anything as unsophisticated as, say, housekeeping, all the way up to skilled nursing, but it's chronic maintenance care and does not need physician's orders, and frequently, it involves just personal care services, helping someone bathe, those sorts of things.
Kirsten Starr.
Thank you. I'm a little bit concerned about voting this out, and that it seems to me we're creating another job for another state agency, another fee, another expansion of government's reach into personal business and people's lives. It seems to me that from a letter that Ms. McRobert wrote, and she basically said, this is the issue that I have with the bill that the provider gave her and listed her objections and said this is what she's going to do, and that sort of remedy is available to folks, and ultimately the court system is available to folks, you know, to pursue when they have issues and cases that they have a problem with. Would you wish to comment on that issue?
Mr. Chair, President Starr, the agency is already in place, of course, and so we're not creating a new agency. Presently, these people not being licensed, their ability is somewhat in question. And given the type of people that we're dealing with here, senior citizens, people who are ill, probably unable to care for themselves readily, are not going to be the kind of people primarily who will go to the court system to find relief for problems where they've been taken advantage of, either financially or the kind of care they've received. They just are not inclined to do that. In the case with the Roberts, Mr. Roberts, McRoberts, had a stroke and certainly would not be able to have made this complaint on his own. His wife, obviously, is the one who took that in hand and did that. In many instances, these people are not in a position to be able to do that. So my view is that if we are able to license these people that are already connected to an agency before they go into the situation, there would be some way to control the kind of care that's given to these people, and I think that's the issue. There are just too many people that are having a problem to just say, take care of it yourself.
Listen, sir.
I appreciate that response. I think the fact that we are dealing perhaps with elderly and frail folks, that's certainly could justify creation of this new licensing program. However, I haven't had, and my phone has been ringing off the hook with people that have problems in this area. It seems to me that in the letter from Mrs. McRobert, the issue was more with billing for services that weren't rendered or little fine points as far as the bills that she received. And I'm not sure that passing this bill and having this licensure program would preempt or not take care of that problem. I think just they're going to have problems with folks billing for services that weren't rendered or other questions as far as what kinds of services were provided. Any comment on that?
For the record, I'm going to say again, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, the consideration that we gave to the complaint was not really based on a financial disagreement that Gus and McRobert had with the provider. Actually, it had to do with substandard care of her husband. It just so happens that she has a nursing background. However, if she was a general member of the public, she recognized that there was many areas of care that her husband received that was truly harmful to him, and it actually went against the agreements that she had with the business that was going to provide competent care. One of the failures that she noted was the failure to follow OSHA rules on the use of powdered latex gloves, for example. He had some tubes. There was substandard cleaning of the tubes. There were many other things that we have not provided to you. Actually, about four pages here that she did provide to us. The financial disagreement that she had was over double billing, and there was really no place for her to go other than the court system because there was no way that she could complain to the state and that they would have any oversight of that particular business. Now, when we first received her complaint, I went to a state book, and I looked at the Department of Human Resources, and I was fortunate enough on my third call to find Kathleen Snail from the Oregon Health Division. And I asked her, how many complaints do you receive? And she said, I can't really tell you because we don't regulate those businesses. And so we don't really have an idea of how the public is being harmed by these businesses that are unregulated. If we believe that the individuals who contract for home health, which is another level of care, if it's important enough for them to be regulated and to protect the public there, we believe that it's no less important to protect those individuals who need respite care from a business like this in their home. We have individuals who may need bathing, for example, but we have no idea without any background checks that these people are even not convicted felons, for example. And this bill also provides for a vacuum check, which also is very appropriate.
Thank you very much.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. Could someone describe to me in the definition of in-home care services for what are we talking about when we talk specifically about an individual under an arrangement? Is that with the agency? And what does that look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, what we're talking about is an agency, an in-home care agency that may have some employees but may not employ a certain individual with the expertise needed, and so may contract with individuals to come. And under that arrangement, they would be serving, in effect, as employees of the agency, although under contract.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
Just so I understand, we're not talking about somebody, or maybe we are, a neighbor who wants to provide some in-home care to a few elderly. We're talking about... Okay. Thank you.
I've read the
donation. A couple other questions. I mean, obviously, sort of the policy discussion in my mind is, I think the intent of the bill is good. It's a question, as always, when you set up the ability to regulate is the ability to enforce. And I guess, can you enforce this? I mean, and that, you know, given you have, at least in your testimony, some additional enforcement provisions for other things, is this something you could keep up with at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe that this bill gives the Department of Human Resources the same ability that it gives it to regulate home health agencies, in that the license can be revoked or denied, and then you know, one can take out an injunction. There's nothing in here about civil penalties, for example, nor is there for home health agencies, which we currently do license.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point being that if you can do inspections or making sure that they're following by the rules, you have the ability to do that. We ask a lot of agencies to enforce laws or the regulations, and again, I believe the intent is good. It's just, which is the intent of the sponsor, which is to make sure that people are living by certain rules. Can you keep up with that? I guess we hear a lot from agencies that they're having a hard time with current law. So I'm just want to make sure for the record that we're clear that this is something you could do in fulfillment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, first of all, we don't really have a clear understanding of exactly how many of these agencies are out there. So what we're giving you is an educated guess, but based on what we anticipate finding when we do that review, and the fact that we will be working with the other agencies in the Department of Human Resources, and the fact that there will be fees to support this, I believe that we can carry it out.
How many other alternatives were available to Dusty McRoberts and other people who could have came in and provided the care?
Yes, Mr. Chair. She originally found out about this particular provider from a brochure that she picked up in a hospital lobby. And the fact that it was provided there, in her mind, gave it a certain level of credibility. And subsequently, I believe that brochure has been pulled from that hospital lobby at this time. But I think that was just the tip of the iceberg, actually, because in her mind, she believed that was an endorsement of services that were available to her.
Okay, do you have any idea of how many other competing businesses there are, or other competing for that same business that this brochure advertised from, Helping Hands from outside in Portland? How many other businesses are competing for that same business? How many alternatives did Dusty McRoberts have? Other places to go, she's getting substandard care from these people. How many other providers are out there that were willing to come in and provide the service?
Mr. Chair, we did attempt to determine that number, but there was really no place that we could go to find that number. She has subsequently found another provider.
Mr.
Chair, my question is perhaps of committee staff or maybe of the witnesses, but didn't this body already pass House Bill 1169, which gave the public authority for in-home licensing care, or I guess it's Senate bill? Or isn't that already in the hopper as well? Where is that at?
Let's check. I don't know the answer. Question, Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This man, I have a very general question, and that is, obviously, given the position that you have within the health division, someone could speculate that you may have thought about whether or not this regulation was necessary before this bill was introduced. Can you tell me what your feelings were about regulating this portion of the industry, and whether or not you've ever proposed to people that perhaps this is something what the health department should be doing and isn't doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, this is something that has been discussed from time to time, not only in the health division, but I know that other agencies in the Department of Human Resources have looked at this, as has the, my understanding is at least that sometime a few years ago, the Home Health Agency Provider Association, the Oregon Association for Home Care, was considering sponsoring the bill. I don't think that they did. I do know that last session, I think it was House Bill 2905, was proposed by an individual from Lincoln City, and I don't believe that got a hearing.
Right.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding from previous discussions about a similar issue was that there was somewhat of a concern, and it doesn't relate directly to Ms. McRoberts' situation, but that these providers that were affiliated with hospitals were getting sort of preferential referral versus other providers in the community, and that some belief that there should be a broader system for people to understand who the providers were that were out there and what their qualifications were. So I remember I was on the Human Resources Committee in the last session, and there were these three or four different meetings, I believe, on one of the bills that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, there was a bill, and I believe it was introduced at least at the request of a number of individuals, but one was the same individual. And at the time, that person worked in a home health agency, and my understanding of that bill was that it was aimed toward home health agencies, those that were hospital-based and those that were freestanding. I do know that the federal government has revised its Medicare regulations for hospitals to require hospitals, prior to discharging a patient who needs home health services, to give that patient a list of all of the available home health agencies in the community in which that patient lives, so that the patient does have a choice. And of course, the hospital-based home health agency is one of those choices, as is the other.
Any further questions? I have one. Home health agencies you currently regulate, how many complaints do you have with those, and are you able to follow up satisfactorily with those complaints?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, yes. Last year, and I'm talking about federal fiscal years, we received 6 complaints against home health agencies. This year, and we've just completed 9 of the 12 months in the fiscal year, we've received 4. And we have been able to carry out those investigations.
I'll follow up on that. How many home health agencies are there in the state that you regulate?
Representative Starr, there are 83 at this time.
And do you have any idea how many of these in-home care services folks that you're going to, that this bill is addressing, there are in the state that you're going to regulate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, we don't have an absolute firm number, but our educated guess is that there are approximately 150 of them that would meet the definition in this bill.
And could you clarify in simple terms, I mean, I think Representative Edwards asked this question, and that's still not very clear to me. It seems to me that these in-home services folks are very similar to the home health agencies. It seems to me that they do very similar things.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I have is, why can't we just assume or have that one agency or one regulation cover the ball? Is that what we're really doing, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, they do provide some of the very same services to their clients. There are some fundamental differences, however. First of all, home health agencies provide care that is intended to be rehabilitative. The patient is expected to recover or at least regain some ability. And in in-home care agencies, that's not usually the case. Another fundamental difference is that home health agencies admit patients upon physician's order, and all of the care that's provided and the treatments are provided according to physician's orders. And an in-home care agency doesn't require physician's orders, although, you know, there's nothing to keep them from calling up and getting those orders. But any citizen can pick up the phone and call an in-home care agency and ask for someone to come out to provide housekeeping or what we would traditionally think of as services provided by a home health aide or a nurse's aide, bathing, grooming, those sorts of things, or skilled nursing, because there may be some clients, for example, who are on ventilators and require nursing care, skilled nursing, but it's not rehabilitative. They're probably going to be on the ventilators for the rest of their lives. So there's a fundamental difference there.
Great. That clears it up for me. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you both very much for bringing this forward today. Is there anyone else who wishes to briefly comment on this bill? Briefly? Mr. Higginson and... I'm not sure.
Chair Star, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state health officer and deputy administrator with the Oregon Health Division. And actually, I wasn't going to testify on this, but when some of the questions about clarifying what the services are, I thought I'd come up because I had some personal experience recently because my mother was discharged from the hospital last Friday and is now currently living with us at home. And when she was being discharged, we were trying to figure out what services she was going to have at home while she was living with us. And she does need some physical therapy, and she needs some nursing services. And so the health system that she's associated with, they will provide those services. We have a physical therapist coming out two or three times a week now, and a nurse coming out once or twice a week. And those are only for like 1 or 2 hour visits at a time. What we really need right now is we need someone to take care of her for the 6 hours that my wife and I are both at work and cannot cover that care. What we want to have is not necessarily a nurse, but we want to have someone there who is familiar with health issues, can follow the instructions given by a physical therapist, can follow the instructions given by an is acquainted enough with healthcare issues that person can provide medications, can monitor the oxygen flow and those kind of things. So that what I think that the difference is that the home health provides very short-term, very limited services that's at the direction of the physician, and what the home care person is doing is the much more maintenance care. It may be something as simple as house cleaning, bathing, and those kind of grooming things, but a lot more often it actually has some health components that are related as well.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Higginson? Thanks.
My name is Catherine White with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council, and I just wanted to follow up a little bit on a comment that Representative Edwards made. It's our understanding that this bill applies to those organizations that hold themselves out as businesses and actually provide individuals who are employees of that business to provide the support and service, or contract employees of that business to provide the support and services to the family or individual that's requested that support, and that it does not apply to respite organizations or small fiduciary organizations that are providing some support and services to individuals. And I think I've spoken with Representative Sinceri, and we've discussed this issue, and it is not the intent to impact those kind of services, but primarily those that are businesses holding themselves out as providing a certain level of care to an individual or a family.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. White? Thank you both very much. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else wish to testify? Very good. Since we have another member, we will then Chair, I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3635 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
President Byer made a motion to move 3635 to the floor of the due pass. Any discussion on the motion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Excuse.
Representative Manning.
Excuse.
Representative
Starr. Aye.
Chair Simmons.
Excuse. Motion passes. Representative Sinceri, you wish to carry the bill? Thank you very much. Close work session on House Bill 3635. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 723. I had a sign up sheet for talking to people. Great. Let's see how. have Steve Delaney from PERS come first. To
please proceed. Representative Starr, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. The PERS Board has considered Senate Bill 723 and has not taken a position on this bill. They did want me to indicate to the committee that that indeed is not a neutral position, which they felt might indicate they didn't care either way, but indeed it's a no position because they did not feel it was their place to indicate to this committee what actions to take with regard to the board composition. However, they did want PERS staff to indicate to this committee some concerns that the PERS Board did have with the bill, and these are outlined in the handout that's been provided to you. In the bill, on lines 11 and 12 of page 1, it indicates that the public members should have experience or knowledge of investing. The PERS Board wanted to point out that the board itself does not do any investing and felt that it was inappropriate as a requirement for a PERS Board member. That's actually the Oregon Investment Council that does the investing portion of PERS funds. The second item they wish to point out is occasionally where a PERS Board member who moves over to serve on the Oregon Investment Council does have investment knowledge because of having investment earnings or businesses involved in investments, that it has created a conflict of interest for that person working on the Oregon Investment Council. So they were just raising that as a concern. The third item they wish to point out was the fact that the legal fiduciary responsibility of a PERS board member would not change whether the board member was a public member or a PERS participant, that the legal responsibilities remain the same, and therefore, contrary to what may have been testified on the Senate side regarding the need for this bill, the PERS board did not see that the recomposition of the board would have any impact on actions they've taken to date. Finally, the fourth item that I wish to point out came from the PERS Legislation Subcommittee of the Board, and they simply wish to point out their concern that in this particular bill, 723, it would cut elected officials' representation from 2-1. They were concerned about that because of elected officials being the closest board members to the tax-paying public. Currently, that the board only has one elected official member serving, the other individual having been replaced by a retired member who can swing either way. We do have another individual ready to come on board who is an elected official, so we would have two elected officials, but that appointment has been held up from the governor's desk waiting for outcome of this particular bill. I am available to answer any questions that committee members may have regarding this.
Any questions, Mr. Delaney? Representative Edwards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could step back a little bit and give the committee a little overview of what the PERS Board's responsibilities are, what the makeup is, and how that group functions, and then how the Oregon Investment Company functions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the PERS Board is an 11-member board at this time. It has four union members that serve on the board. It has three public members that serve on the board. It has two management members serving on the board, and finally, it has two elected official members serving on the board, although there's a 12th person that can come and go as needed by the governor, that is a retiree, and currently the retiree position was taking one of the elected official positions. The PERS board itself oversees the plan as a whole and has the responsibility to ensure that the plan is given to it by the Oregon legislature, is properly administered. The PERS board directs PERS staff as far as the actions to be taken with implementation of legislation that comes from the Oregon legislature requiring changes to benefits. The PERS board does provide one member, currently is one of the public members, who serves also on the Oregon Investment Council. The Oregon Investment Council is the group of five members who actually direct the investments of the PERS fund. The Oregon Investment Council works under the Oregon State Treasury, so it's sort of this triumvirate of the PERS Board, Treasury, and Oregon Investment Council. The PERS Board member, again, has a vote on that committee. in addition, the PERS director serves on the Oregon Investment Council but does not have a vote on that council. He's actually a sixth member of that committee with no voting powers. Does that serve the...
Thank you. Just follow on. Yes, I appreciate it. Actually, I'd like to explore one thing you just said, which I think is sort of pertinent to the whole bill, which is that the PERS board follows the legislative, the legislature and its law relative to what the PERS benefits are. The board does not set the benefits. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Gardner.
Yeah, I have to forgive me for coming in a little bit late, but basically what you're doing in one portion of this bill under line 22 is taking the public employee members from 4 to 2, and I didn't hear what your rationale
is. Actually, Representative Gardner, Mr. Delaney is not supporting the bill. He's just explaining it. It's Senator Dirksler and Bryant that are proposing to do that.
Okay.
Just to clarify.
Okay. Okay. On the Senate side, what was the rationale?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I hesitate to explain the rationale of the other parties. As I understand it, the concern was that the outlook of a board member might be influenced by whether or not the person participates in the plan. That was the concern raised by those that were proposing this change. You notice on item 3 of the handout I've given you, that is a particular issue that the PERS board has addressed, saying that the legal fiduciary responsibility of a board member, whether they're public or private, would not change. And so, therefore, the board did not see how this recomposition would have changed any actions taken by the board.
Is that it? I take care of it, Mr. Gardner?
Not exactly.
Further questions?
Close enough.
Representative Devlin?
In the last legislative session, I think you touched on it briefly. They changed the composition of the board in the last session. Can you explain that? And my understanding is, from just your comments there and previous comments made to me, that change hasn't fully taken effect yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that's correct. It increased the board from 9 to 11 members, and included in that were two elected officials. However, if you notice in the bill, you see what's being changed and why it didn't take place previously. On lines 30 and 31, after listing the 11 members of the board, the current law states that in lieu of one member appointed with the qualification specified in paragraph C, which is management, paragraph D, which is the elected official, or E, which is the public employee, you could have a retired member. And that's what happened. The board was increased to 11 members. It could have had two elected officials in place, but because there was a retired member provided for under lines 30 through 32, there was only one elected official. So the board stayed at 11, one elected official. That retired member has now left the board, has resigned from the board, and they are now ready. There has been a second elected official suggested by the governor to be placed onto the board, and that appointment has been held up pending the outcome of this particular bill.
Any further questions?
Well, no, sir. I think it would be good for you to also put on the record, you made a statement which I think is very strong, and that is your point 3 about the fiduciary responsibilities. Could you just describe those a little bit about how much of a box that is, and what are you talking about? Those are federal laws, if I understand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that is correct. The PERS board has been advised closely by the Attorney General's office with regard to the obligations of the PERS board and its responsibilities to the fiduciary responsibilities to the beneficiaries of the fund, the beneficiaries of the fund being public employees. There has been a lot of question as to how far the board or the trust fund could be used to help out, for instance, public employers, which has been the big issue in the news. And federal law is really very clear that the PERS fund must benefit the beneficiaries, the employees. And so no matter what action the PERS board might take, it must comply with that federal requirement that the beneficiaries be benefited by whatever actions the board takes. So that has been, as you put it, a box around the actions of the board.
Any further questions? I just have one. Has there been a problem on the first board with having too many public employee members?
Mr. Chair, there hasn't. As a matter of fact, we were asked recently if someone could look at the votes of the board to see whether there had been splits between the public versus private members. And we went back looking at the past 2 years, and it has been very minimal. And none of the votes were ever a split of public versus private. It was more opinions difference. You might have one public member and one private member on a side of an issue, while another public member and another private member on a different side of the issue. There have been not been any splits in the past 2 years that we could determine by that split on those lines.
The first board meets under the open meetings law of the state?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Any further questions? Representative Devlin.
How often does the board meet?
Mr. Chair, the board meets 10 times a year.
Second question. Do you attend some of those meetings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, yes, I do.
Okay. Could you give us some idea of some of the matters the board might act on at a typical meeting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, it can be quite varied. They have to confirm contested case hearings where a member is contesting a benefit that may or may not have been paid to them in the manner they wished, and so it's gone to a contested case hearing, and the hearings officer issues an opinion, and then the board must hear that opinion and confirm it and make that decision. They review PERS staff actions to determine service levels being provided to PERS members so that they can determine whether or not staff should take certain actions to improve or increase service levels. They also listen to concerns such as currently we've had this issue with the employer rates, which the rates are set by the PERS board. The PERS board takes suggestions from the actuary as to what's needed to maintain the fiscal strength of the system, and the PERS board makes that decision as to what interest rates should be determined and what contribution rates should be paid by employers. Employers are able to come to the board and express their concerns, which has been the case, talking about different suggestions they would make with regard to the plan and how the plan might be patterned in such a way as to bring about relief to employers. And the board has made extraordinary efforts to try to do that as much as they can, keeping in mind that box placed around them of the fiduciary responsibility they have to the beneficiaries of the plan, but doing as much as they can to maintain the stability of the fund, both for employer and the beneficiaries of that plan.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Delaney, very much for your explanation this afternoon. Like Bob Livingston and Mary Botkin, please.
Mr. Chair, while the witnesses are coming up, we do have a letter from Maria Keltner from the Local Government Personnel Institute in support of Central 723. I will distribute that.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and we're here to voice some concern over Senate Bill 723, and I think that Mr. Delaney did a very nice job of kind of outlining the duties and the responsibilities of the board, being very clear that regardless of the particular makeup of the board, there is a fiduciary responsibility law that covers those board members. And I think it's also important to comment that fiduciary responsibility when it comes to retirement boards does not just cover public employees, but also covers the private sector. This is a fairly all-encompassing law or set of laws that cover all retirement boards in both public and the private sector. I wanted to talk just a minute about kind of how we got to where we are and why we are where we are. When I first started working at the legislature, the PERS board had, I believe, 7 members. And the board was pretty bogged down in a lot of work and was not able to get things done in a timely manner and was a bit unproductive, extra time. And so at that time, then Governor Goldschmidt added two members. And then a couple of sessions later, after some issues were raised about the fact that the private sector wasn't represented at all, that the, quote, taxpayers weren't represented, another two members were added. But I think it's important that in the mix of changing the board, an interesting thing has occurred, and that is that the board has learned very effectively to work together. And, you know, when asked how many split votes there are, you know, I think that the board, like a lot of us, find out that sometimes it's better to work your way through to a consensus and find a solution that solves the problem rather than to just kind of beat each other up. And that really is where the board is. And if you go in and observe the board, it would be virtually impossible to tell who are private sector representatives, who are union sector representatives, and who are elected officials or public sector representatives unless you just knew. And, you know, I will be the first one to admit that when we added private sector business folks to the board, I had some concern about whether or not those changes would have a negative impact on the effectiveness and the productivity of the board. And I must say that those public, those private sector folks have offered some very insightful information in administering the programs that the board is responsible for. I think there's a couple of other things that are really important to understand, and that is that PERS, as most retirement systems are, is very, very complicated. It is kind of its own little knowledge base in itself. And it takes us a long time to get folks trained and up to speed about what are all the programs available under PERS. How is PERS administered? How is a retirement system administered? What are the ins and outs of it? What does it mean when they talk about, you know, a projected actuarial analysis? What do all those things mean? And so, you know, when you start moving to change the board, you need to think about the knowledge base that you're leaving vacated as well. And we've noticed that even with the retirement of board members, that, you know, it leaves a real hole sometimes in bringing that new person up to speed. The other thing that the board does, which is a very important piece of their work, is they hire the actuary. And they hire an actuary who is outside of the system. Currently, the actuary's been here a couple of times, Mark Johnson with Millman and Roberts. I think that, you know, clearly that is one of the most important things that they do, is hire the actuary who projects the numbers, who create the rates that either work or don't work. And so I think that, you know, all in all, I think that as we work through this process, we would encourage you to really take a look at the effectiveness of the board. You know, an effective board is a board that doesn't make everybody happy all the time, and certainly the board has made decisions that we've not been delighted with, as have they made decisions that the employers have not been delighted with. You know, the idea here is that we ought to be able to work through those problems, and we ought to be able to work through it with a group of people, not in an adversarial role, but in conjunction with, you know, how can we best help you get what you need, and how can we best help get the product to the member? And that is our job, and that is the job of the board, is to get the retirement process working for the members, both employers and the members. And with that, we would encourage you. Oh, and I do think there was a misunderstanding. There is not a floating member of 12. It's 11. I mean, there's 11 members of the board. The retiree position has to be one of those 11. If that's not accurate, then we've missed the boat by not having one more board member. But my understanding is that the retiree, one of the 11 sitting members of the board must be a retiree to make sure that their interests and concerns are met.
Thank you, Mr. Livingston.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, Legislative Director of Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'm also a firefighter here in Salem. You have my written testimony in front of you. I'd like to briefly just hit upon some of the more pertinent points that I think are relevant to the issue that some of the people have not spoken on. First of all, as I've watched this bill progress from the Senate side over to the House side, it was mentioned by some, in speculatively speaking, that some people believe that if we would have had a reconfiguration of the PERS board, that maybe some of the situations that are currently being addressed in other bills wouldn't have occurred. And what I'm alluding to is the Supreme Court decision that we all know about and related to another bill, an unprecedented stock market, and then some of those decisions that were made by local employers. What happened, obviously, is all those came together, as you know, in a rare phenomena and occurred at one time. And some have speculated that if we would have had a reconfiguration of the board at that time, that wouldn't occur. Well, that's simply not true. I think Mr. Delaney has testified in the fact that that certainly isn't true. And I wouldn't expand upon that other than to say that it was a rare phenomenon. Even the actuaries stated that the chances of that happening again are very, very remote and almost virtually impossible. What I would like to do briefly is just give you a little bit of maybe legislative history, and I know that some of you that are on this committee probably have much better legislative history than I have, but I would like to just suggest that that the legislature has already addressed some of the issues and some of the concerns that have been brought up. For example, in 1987, the Oregon legislature expanded the PERS board to more broadly represent members of the system. During the 1987 legislature, there was bipartisan support to expand the board to really delve into what Mr. Delaney was explaining, what the function of the PERS board is. And a lot of it is administrative in nature. It's to service the members, and when you have a question, they're there to answer them for you. As an example, and as you can read in my testimony, during that time prior to 1987, colleagues that preceded you were getting inundated with phone calls from members of the PERS system saying, hey, where's my check? It's been 6 months. I've retired. I told my check was going to be here. It hasn't. Well, in their wisdom, the legislature decided that, okay, enough of these. We've just been inundated with members from calls. We need to do something. In effect, what they did is they reconfigured the board to what it, in effect, what it is right now, where we have a good balance, not only labor folks, but management as well as private citizens that, as Mary mentioned, have worked well together to solve some of these, along with that box that they work with inside fiduciary responsibility. But really, a lot of what the administrative does is answer members' questions on things and be there as kind of a person that understands it. So I think that I would just briefly mention that we've already been down this road. It was a bipartisan bill that was brought in front of the 1987 legislature. They decided that this was a good thing to do. I would argue that we've been down this path before. Currently, the system that we have in place, the PERS board configuration, is one that is working well, and one that I would suggest to you that it's a path that we don't need to travel down again. We've corrected some of those administrative problems that the PERS board is having to deal with. And with that, I would just urge you not to proceed this bill any further. I think the testimony has shown that we have a good board configuration as it currently stands. And with that, I would entertain any questions that you have.
Any questions for these two witnesses? Representative Edwards?
Again, that puts you in a difficult spot, but looking at the engrossed bill on page 2, line 1 through line 5, there's a direct effect on your organization. Do you know what the rationale for that was? Well, at least publicly, what was spoken of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's a question that I can't answer. It would be a speculative answer that I could give you on that. Certainly, police and firefighters are concerned with the change that this bill would propose. Certainly, as you well know, there are some differences for police and fire folks that occur within the PERS system, and we do have some problems with that. But I think it would probably be just speculation on my to answer why. I could give you an opinion that whether that's appropriate this time, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I need to comment that, you know, there are some very basic differences in kind of each of the sectors of government. And, you know, one of the reasons that the sectors were outlined the way they are was to address those major blocks of kind of, you know, public sector groups, and within that, teachers and classified school employees have one set of needs that may be a little different than firefighters, and certainly firefighters and police officers have a whole different set of needs that aren't shared the other way. But it's also true with local government and state government, and some of it has to do with just funding areas and where the funding comes from. And so, you know, the interest was to make sure that all four areas, all four of the major areas were covered, and those interests were met and concerns were more available to the board and meeting.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony this afternoon. Call Michelle Smith, Trisha Bozak, and Trisha Smith, please. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Well, for the record, I am pinch hitting for Rich Pepper. He's out of town for the day, and so I am he. My name is Michelle Smith. I am representing Oregon Public Employees Union, Local 503, Service Employees International Union. I will just summarize the points that you'll see on my testimony. It's not needed. It is based on misrepresentation of the board's duties. It runs counter to the accepted practices in the field, and it creates instability on the PERS board. And those are the things that, those are four basic reasons why this bill should stop its process where it is now. So we hope that you will look at those four reasons. I think Mr. Delaney did an excellent job in laying out those, Mary and Bob did an excellent job of laying those out, too, so we'll just reiterate those are the four reasons. You can repeat those back with me. It's not needed. It is based on misrepresentation of the board duties. It runs counter to the accepted practices in the field, and it creates instability on the PERS board. So if we can remember those four things, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, and we should give a lesson to that. Next.
Uh-oh. Friends are gone.
I can do it.
No, I have it right here. Mine.
I'll take it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Trisha Bozak, representing the Oregon Education Association. The OEA does oppose Senate Bill 723 because we see it as unnecessary, point number one that Ms. Smith mentioned. One of the things I like to point out is that Oregon's retirement board is not atypical from other retirement boards around the country. A 1997 survey showed that 56 out of 66 major state and local public employee systems had as the majority of their membership on that board participant members. So that's nothing new. Several people went through the chronology of the board's expansion and change in membership. I would point out that if Senate Bill 723 were to move forward, it would be the fourth reconfiguration of the board in 13 years. We think some stability would be a good thing on this board, and that these changes aren't particularly necessary, especially in light of the fact that the 1995 changes that were made have not been fully implemented yet. Someone touched upon the reason for having different sectors of public employees represented. I think in talking to some of the PERS board members, their constituent groups, if you will, do contact them periodically with concerns, and I think they feel like having someone who understands their work situation on the board, that's a positive thing. We don't feel like, though, that unduly enriches benefits for members. In fact, the legislature sets the level of benefits, not the PERS board. The OIC does the investing. So, and Mr. Delaney mentioned the request of the PERS about what the votes look like between public members and participant members. I was the one who had requested that information, and indeed, since 1997, an examination of those votes didn't show rare conflict between public members and participant members on the board. I don't think a case can be made for them.
So with those comments, and you have my written testimony, we would just urge that this bill not go forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, a union of classified school employees, and you know where. Since my colleagues have all so eloquently given you all the really good reasons why this bill should not go forward, the best I can do is repeat them with one exception. And that exception is I am the lone holder of the single piece of supporting testimony that I understand that you have on this bill, and that being from LGPI. And I would like to comment on the reason given to support the bill, and that is that in the third paragraph of that testimony, Ms. Keltner says that you should support it because restructuring the board so that the majority of members are not PERS members will reduce the possibility that board decisions could be influenced by self-interest. If you go back to the reason, the duties of the PERS board, and you think of those duties and what they are, the board's function is to assure that benefits reach recipients as they should, that PERS participants are educated about their retirement plan, and that they have access to the system when they need it and when they are eligible to receive benefits. So it makes sense to me that there be members of the board who have a self-interest, that is, they are participants within the system. It makes sense because they understand what they get at work in terms of education on their retirement system, and they may understand what is deficient in that education process for PERS members. That's their job. So self-interest is not a bad thing in terms of representation on the board. Currently, there is not a majority of members on the board who are PERS participants. There are six who are members of the system, and, well, I guess that is a majority, and five who are not. Well, okay, a slim majority. I'll say slim majority. However, it's important that members of the board have some understanding of the system from the perspective of other participants. So I think that the reason that you were given to support the bill is exactly the reason to oppose it. And with that, I will say me too to everything else you've heard on the bill today. Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? None. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today. Anyone else wishes to testify? Senate Bill 723. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 723. No other business before our committee. We're adjourned.